Hi, I'm Justin Elliott, a reporter at ProPublica, and welcome to our Muck Reads podcast. Today, we welcome G.W. Schultz of the Center for Investigative Reporting to the show. For the past few months, Schultz and his colleague Andrew Becker have been writing about federal programs that are putting heavy equipment and weapons usually associated with the military into the hands of state and local police around the country. The stories shed light on how federal taxpayer dollars are driving the transformation of police into forces that sometimes resemble small armies. I spoke with GW on Tuesday, April 10th, about how he got started reporting on the story, who has oversight of the situation, and what tips he has for other people who might want to look into it. So you and your colleague, Andrew Becker, have for a while now sort of been tracking the ways in which local and state police are, becoming sort of increasingly militarized, getting their hands on military-style equipment and large guns and aircraft and that sort of thing. So can you tell me how you sort of started looking into this phenomenon?
Yeah, so more broadly, we were interested in how the war on terror was changing local law enforcement in the United States, how local police perceived the threats they faced day-to-day and sort of what they were doing, what they were investing in, how they were training around that perceived threat. So we did a lot of reporting last year on intelligence collection and analysis, which has been a huge trend in local policing since 9/11, but it's really picked up steam in recent years. The big phrase that's thrown around a lot is intelligence-led policing. How can we use information? How can we collect and analyze information in a way that enables us to intercept crimes and intercept terrorist attack planning before it occurs, right? But on the equipment side, too, there was a sort of revolution taking place in law enforcement also. And part of that was fueled with federal Homeland Security grants, which have reached about $37 billion now since 2002. And we'd spent a lot of time collecting records state by state around those grants to see what types of things people were buying. We had a pretty good idea, but we really wanted to get into those records and see what sorts of patterns were emerging.
So what have you found in terms of trends with respect to what police are getting their hands on?
I mean, with the grants, it was a lot of combat-style equipment. So there were certain items that community after community was purchasing. I mean, to some extent, law enforcement can be as sort of vulnerable to trends as teenagers can when it comes to jeans. One jurisdiction gets armor personnel carrier, the next jurisdiction wants to have one too. And it's not that they're doing it simply because it's a trend. They genuinely believe they need it. And they see the next jurisdiction getting what they believe is a critical piece of equipment that can make their job better or safer, so they do it too, right? So we saw very, very common big-ticket items were things like the armored personnel carriers, particularly the Bearcat, just sort of a shiny law enforcement-oriented bank-looking car, for lack of better description. lots of combat-style helmets, combat-style protective gear, like tactical gear, from head to toe. For some jurisdictions, it might only be helmets and flak jackets. But for others, it could be head-to-toe tactical equipment, which is what we saw. I mean, everything from shin guards to elbow guards to chest plates to all the way up to helmets. I mean, head-to-toe SWAT attire, basically. And for some jurisdictions, they already had a tactical component, like a SWAT team, but the grant funds really helped them beef up those units.
And what are the grant funds earmarked for? I mean, did Congress say what it should be used for?
All right, so the logic in the beginning was like this. There were a few grant programs that already existed prior to 9/11, and they were funded, in much smaller dollar amounts than they are today. The logic behind them was to create a new capability for jurisdictions where capability didn't exist previously. So if you're a rural sheriff's department and you don't have a search and rescue team for people who were hiking and fall off cliffs, the grants, as an example, were supposed to be to field and train and equip a search and rescue team. And the idea was that you aimed for filling out these 16 capabilities that we wanted every jurisdiction in the country to have at a basic level so that you were ready at all times for basically anything imaginable, earthquake, tornado, terrorist attack, you name it, right? But along the way, there's been a lot of politics involved and a lot of jurisdictions complaining that they wanted to be able to use the money for different things. So there was a big political fight, for instance, a couple of years ago in which the state and local communities complained to FEMA that they wanted to be able to use the grant money to sustain equipment they'd already purchased. That means buy new tires for the Bearcat, reupholster the inside of the mobile incident command truck, things like that. And initially, the feds tried to balk at that, saying, no, it doesn't match what we envisioned with these grant programs, which was to create new capabilities, not sustain what you already bought. You have to make an investment here, too, and maintain and stay trained on the stuff you already purchased. Well, the state and locals won because they're good at pressuring their representatives in Congress to, in turn, pressure agencies like FEMA to meet their desires. They don't always win. There's still a lot of red tape around the grant programs, but they have been able to push here and there to get more of what they want out of the grants and what the feds think they should be doing with the money.
So are you looking at sort of a whole collection of post-9/11 grant programs, or is this under one umbrella? I mean, how is it all structured?
Yeah, I mean, so there, like I said, there were a handful of grant programs previously, but the list of individual grants you could apply for grew really fast. So sometimes you'll see news stories that say the Urban Area Security Initiative grant has been slashed by 15%. And then there'll be quotes from a local sheriff saying this is going to devastate us. But if you're familiar with the grant programs, you know that there's a dizzying array of them that communities are eligible for, not just from DHS, but from the Justice Department, from EPA for securing water systems, for instance. But if you have a savvy grant writing unit, you can pull down quite a bit of federal money for your department. There's a lot of red tape and paperwork around it, but you can get a lot of money.
So how were you able? I mean, from as a reporting matter, I mean, how were you able to get at the data of where the money's going and how it's being spent? I mean, is it all in one place somewhere?
No, not even close. And when we first started out, we launched our Homeland Security Project in 2008, sort of sensing that a lot of newsrooms were figuring out how to cover it as a beat because there's all these subjects that intersect at Homeland Security. So we said, well, why don't we examine this for a while? Initially, we thought there might be something along those lines, not an extremely detailed database, but we thought there'd be something DHS is maintaining that would give us a pretty solid idea of the categories of spending. For instance, maybe they would have total dollar amounts on tactical equipment as opposed to surveillance cameras, as opposed to vehicles, things like that. That didn't exist. So we had to go state by state and use open government laws to request from everybody. What we were aiming for in each case was a spreadsheet with line items of each and everything that they purchased. But the states were left to decide for themselves how expenditures would be tracked, especially in the beginning. So some states, after communicating with them a bunch, would send us a PDF with next to nothing in it of value that we could use to report from. Other states like Texas and Washington State gave us richly detailed spreadsheets that we could use to sort and analyze. And in the case of Texas, we turned the database over to the Texas Tribune. They did a story out of it, built an online searchable database for readers to go through and see what their community got. It just totally depended state by state. In the case of Texas, you know, there are 250 counties here, but they still managed to keep track of every expenditure for every county. And it was really easy to search through that data for people to carve out their communities and see what they acquired. In other cases, you know, we had one state tell us everything is in paper. We haven't digitized any of it. So you're welcome to back up with a Xerox machine and a pickup truck and cart away whatever you want. But there's no way we could meaningfully analyze that much paper. Just for that one state would have taken us an eternity.
What state was that?
I can't remember, so I don't want to say. It was one of two southern states. The guy was nice. He wasn't denying my public records request. This was quite a while ago now. He was just saying, you know, you can photocopy whatever you want. Basically, you have all the invoices and paper files, and that's it. I mean, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars in expenditures.
There are still some states, then, that we don't know how they're spending this federal grant money in terms of local police?
No, we technically do. We could if we wanted to go, say, community by community. Like, we had a lot of reporters calling us prior to the 10-year anniversary of 9/11 asking how they could do a story on this. So we had to make sort of piecemeal recommendations. Well, if you're covering this county or this tri-county area, you might ask these individuals for spreadsheets of local expenditures, right? If you're covering just a cluster of counties, it's a little bit easier. In a lot of cases, it's still seemingly difficult to report on what an entire state purchased without going through all the paperwork. And Washington still doesn't have a central database that will give you that answer either. They have some better information than they used to have a few years ago, but they still leave a lot of the responsibility of overseeing grant spending, which now is, you know, into the $30 billion range, $37 billion. They're still leaving a lot of that responsibility to the states to oversee how the money is spent.
So one of your stories a few months ago led with the police department in Fargo, North Dakota, and looked at sort of how they were getting all this heavy military equipment, I believe armored vehicles, and so on. What have that department and law enforcement in general said to you about how they're using these grants and how they're using the equipment, sort of military-style equipment that they are buying with this money?
Virtually every community in the United States has an explanation for why not only they deserve this money, but they deserve more of it. Everybody has some explanation. Some event has occurred in the past. There was this school shooting, or in California, for instance, everyone likes to point to the North Hollywood bank robbery, the late 1990s. It led to a massive shootout between these robbers and police. It was definitely a hairy incident, but to this day, police, every time we interview them, they point to that bank shooting. The bad guys tomorrow could be armed to the teeth and could outgun police. If we don't have this equipment and don't have better firepower, we're not going to be able to battle them. Every jurisdiction has some explanation along those lines. If it's not terrorism in remote areas, it's the meth epidemic, or it's a right-wing militia group or something like that. And each and every one of them has filled out grant applications that they submitted to the federal government that had some explanation in it for why they needed more equipment, right? And Alaska, I remember a few years ago seeing grant applications there for communications equipment and people saying, in the event of a terrorist attack, we would be able to more effectively communicate with one another. Well, there's technically a terrorist attack could occur in Alaska, but the reality is with terrorism, and it's just a little likely event. Terrorism attacks just don't occur that often. So what's happened more often than not is that the equipment's used for everyday law enforcement and for responding to much more common natural disasters.
You had a story last week looking at another program that's driving this phenomenon, which is a program under which local and state police departments can get free equipment from the military once the military is done using it, and you focused on California. How did you start looking at that particular program?
So it was a continuation of our interest in how local law enforcement was changing in particular. So we kept saying to ourselves, well, what else is out there? What else are people eligible for? If we know that they're eligible for all these different types of grant programs, what else are they able to gain access to? A few news stories here and there mentioned what's known as the 1033 program, this DOD program that enables local police to get access to surplus military equipment. But it didn't appear to us that anyone had gone after data showing more specifically what folks had gotten. So we put a request in early to the Defense Logistics Agency, which is a DOD office that runs the law enforcement support office. They're the folks who give this equipment to local cops. We said we want some data on line items of what you folks have given out. Initially, we were going to try to get data on the entire country. It took them some months to get us an initial data set on California, so we just went ahead and moved forward with that story because we knew California had utilized the program pretty heavily. And we have this sister site, California Watch, a component of CIR. And so, well, let's look at that. It's going to give us a lot of insight into this program. We'll just move forward with that. But we did eventually get the data set. It showed up as four different data sets. And I spent a lot of time cleaning it up and fixing it and making it uniform so it was easier to understand and we could analyze it and turn it into a searchable tool for readers. But we ended up with 14,000 rows of items since the early 1990s that folks had taken advantage of.
And are there, were there trends in terms of what sort of equipment police are getting from the military once they're done using it, and also what is the scale that we're talking about here?
Fix some of the numbers that were in the story. I mean, a few things that popped out to us right away was last year, 2011 was the big year in the two-decade history of this program in California. The program had been used far more last year than any other year before since the 1990s. lots of firearms, lots of M16s, lots of armored personnel carriers, lots of helmets, sort of combat-style protective gear. But the interesting thing, too, is that there's lots and lots and lots of stuff the military uses every day that has no sort of combat nature to it. Things like bath mats and toothbrushes and stuff that's used on military bases. So lots of departments were using the program to get very simple stuff like that and save themselves on some expenses. But so we talked about all that in the story. But we were also interested in sort of the military nature of some of the equipment. So when we talked to a guy from the L.A. Sheriff's Office, for instance, he told us there are certain types of vehicles that they can't pursue because they're too militaristic in nature. And then a lot of the equipment, when it shows up green, camouflage, military-style camouflage, they repaint it for a civilian application, which is interesting. Just that process in itself showed the difference between the mission of the military and the mission of civilian law enforcement, which is to minimize violence as much as possible. I mean, it's difficult to argue that police shouldn't take advantage of a program like this, but it was story-worthy to us because there is all kinds of equipment that could alter the image of local law enforcement in the United States and the way they do their jobs. It was worth asking what types of equipment people got and talking to police about it.
Has it been possible to look at sort of the other side of this, which is how this equipment is being used? I mean, is it possible to measure sort of how useful it's been or whether there's a higher rate of, you know, more violent encounters with police now that they have sort of all this military gear?
No, you can only do that anecdotally. I mean, we heard some stories from law enforcement about how useful the equipment was. Like this one jurisdiction told us that they had helped a neighboring jurisdiction find a gunman who had killed two people. But the law enforcement agency was aiding the neighbor. Their county was a little bit warmer, but they had this winter cold weather apparel that they were able to take with them to this northern jurisdiction, and then while they were hunting for this guy at night, it kept them warm. There are lots of little stories like that in which the equipment turned out to be really useful. But you with available data, you can't really link the equipment to whether or not it makes the jobs of police safer. And what we do know is that the rate of violent crime in the United States is down compared to the 1980s and 1990s. And that the volume of officers killed in shooting deaths every year is also down over the last couple of decades. But there have individually been some incidents in the last 2 years especially, particularly heinous police shootings, that raised everyone's concerns again about the extent to which police are protected. I mean, in the minds of police, why would anyone oppose the deployment or use of equipment that can make it safer, easier for them to do their jobs? You know, we quote a guy in our story, a Homeland Security expert, who says, you know, it would be awful if an officer lost their lives because they weren't wearing equipment that was appeared politically controversial, right? It wasn't politically correct. And that's a persuasive argument for a lot of people. Why would you make it more difficult for police to do their jobs? But that doesn't mean that there aren't potential consequences of police altering their image or deploying different types of equipment, or for that matter, launching intelligence collection and analysis programs and using technologies that could undermine the Fourth Amendment. As a reporter, that's all I'm interested in. Is it story-worthy, and what does it say about larger trends in law enforcement? Where the law enforcement in the 21st century looks quite a bit different than it did in the 80s and 90s when the trend was community-oriented policing. Soften the image of law enforcement in order to make it easier for them to get along with reluctant minority communities and things like that. And the war on terror has really challenged that because the perception among police is that they face different threats today. Not only do they face bank robbers and rapists and murderers, they're also facing potential of an attack from bin Laden and his cronies.
Given that this money and equipment is coming from the federal government in large part, I mean, is there anyone on the federal level who's in charge of oversight about how this equipment is being used or the results of the program?
Yeah, there are definitely rules in place for how you can use different types of equipment. But like with Homeland Security grants, what the feds do is designate a state office to oversee the enforcement of a lot of those rules. Because the law enforcement support office, the federal level office that runs this program, it can't go out to every community and make sure everybody's using the equipment properly. So same thing with grant programs. With Homeland Security grant programs, each state's governor designates an office to see through the money and make sure it's being spent appropriately. And occasionally the communities will face an audit from the Inspector General's office, but a lot of the responsibility is left up to the states. So for instance, some types of equipment you get surplus in the military, after 1 year you can sell it. If you decide you no longer need it or it no longer is useful to your mission, you can get rid of that equipment. Well, the state-level agency is responsible for making sure that everyone waits that year period and goes through the appropriate processes for getting rid of that equipment. You can't do that with things like firearms. Technically, the firearms are considered on loan to the local police, and they technically, on paper, still belong to the military. Like there's a combative nature to the equipment. Certain types of vehicles, things like that, still technically belong to the military, but you can hang on to it as long as you want. And a lot of the oversight there, making sure people use the equipment appropriately, is left up to the states.
Have you gotten pushback from the departments or anyone in law enforcement in response to all of your reporting on this?
No, because, I mean, we talked to a lot of them on the front end. I'm a big believer in no surprises. So, I mean, we couldn't call every jurisdiction in California, but, you know, all the law enforcement agencies mentioned in our story, you know, we quoted them and they knew what was coming. I mean, I don't know if it necessarily would come back to us. It might be a conversation they have with readers in their area. If there was someone upset about a piece of equipment, then the law enforcement agency would have to speak to them. But, you know, by the time the story went to press, it was solid. We got the data from the Defense Department. It detailed what each community got. We talked to the law enforcement agencies, whatever their explanation was for getting the equipment, that was their explanation. So we couldn't, you know, they couldn't necessarily attack us or be upset for the story because, I mean, we had the data and we reported it out as clearly and accurately as we could. Plus, in law enforcement circles, there's a conversation underway about the extent to which police do want to alter their image and use tactical teams and things like that. I mean, you know, law enforcement isn't any more monolithic than any other area of public policy. You know, at the Pentagon, there are loads of generals with different views on whether or not we should have even launched the Iraq War to begin with, let alone how it should be handled now. Well, same thing in law enforcement circles. A lot of people had different views about when tactical teams should be used, how much training they should get, what types of equipment they should get. You know, a lot of them, when you talk to them, this is a story that contributes in a healthy way to that discourse, to that debate. I mean, it's sometimes police are seen as like, you know, default defenders of all the decisions they make, and they default in defending the rank and file and things like that. But when you talk to them, it's not true. There are clearly lots of different views in law enforcement about how to do public safety more intelligently in the United States.
So if a reader or, say, a local reporter wants to dig into what's going on in their community in terms of what the local police are getting from the federal government, is there a way for them to do that easily? Is there data they can dig into that's accessible now?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few strategies. I mean, especially if you're covering sort of a smaller area rather than the whole state, you can request from the police department or the local fire department or the local emergency management authority an equipment inventory log of everything that's been purchased with Homeland Security money. That's ideally a spreadsheet that lists everything that's been purchased, the amount, the date it was acquired, what condition it's in, and where it's being held. And the logic there is that, I mean, police departments have inventories for everything, especially things like firearms and vehicles and everything in their possession. But even more so with emergency response equipment, you want to know exactly where it is when an incident occurs. If a tornado strikes, you want to know where the mobile command truck is right away. And that's why you have a very solid, updated inventory log available at all times. And it's worthwhile obtaining that thing and checking it out and see if there's an interesting story to tell. It could just be an explanatory story that says, here's what our community bought over the last decade. And second, as far as the military surplus program goes, you can go to the Defense Logistics Agency's Law Enforcement Support Office and ask them for data on your state or your community and see if they can carve out that information for you. And you're going to want data on watercraft, aircraft, firearms, vehicles, and all the everyday general equipment and parts that communities are eligible for. But like we said before, since that program, each state has an oversight responsibility, you could ask the Law Enforcement Support Office who that agency is in your state that has that responsibility. It might be a state emergency management agency or state police or something like that. Ring them up and ask them if they have a spreadsheet available of everything that's been acquired through the surplus military program since its inception. And start analyzing it, doing in some sorts and looking for trends. Who got the most? What year was the most significant? How many firearms have you acquired? Were there more firearms acquired in recent years as opposed to past years? Have we acquired a lot of aircraft? Are we able to pay for the maintenance and upkeep of a helicopter? I mean, maintaining a helicopter is really, really expensive. So just like load the questions and the stories, story possibilities with data and records like that.
Okay, GW, well, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, totally. Thank you guys so much. I appreciate it.
That was Homeland Security reporter GW Schultz of the Center for Investigative Reporting. To read some of the stories we discussed here, visit cironline.org. Thanks for joining us. If you have a story you would like to submit to MuckReads, tweet it with hashtag MuckReads or email it to muckreads@propublica.org, and we'll share them with our readers. We'll be back soon with another MuckReads podcast. Until then, I'm Justin Elliott for ProPublica. Thanks for listening.